On clothing, there was a prowling energy that Chris guessed was chemical. In the absence of any other escort, he'd been Barranca's only security since leaving Panama City. Chris ushered everybody aboard the copter and into seats. The door cranked itself closed and shut out the wind with an airtight clunk. The pilot turned to look at Chris.
"Yeah, that's it. Take us home."
The copter drifted into the sky. They bent away over the city. Barranca leaned across to the window and peered down at the sprawl below.
"This doesn't seem so terrible," he remarked.
"No," Chris agreed. "From up here, it's not." The tanned face turned to look at him.
"I would not be safe walking in those streets."
"It depends on the exact neighborhood, but as a general rule, no, you wouldn't. You might be attacked and robbed, maybe just have stones thrown at you. At a minimum, you'd be recognized as an outsider and followed. After that," Chris shrugged, "depends on the kind of crowd you draw."
"I am not dressed like you."
"Wouldn't matter. They don't care about politics in the zones. It's tribal, localized gangs, territorial violence."
"I see."
Barranco's gaze went back to the city, sliding past beneath them.
"They have forgotten who did this to them."
"That's one way of looking at it." The rest of the flight passed in silence. They crossed the westward cordons and picked up the beacon for the West End cluster. Machines took the controls, read the flight data, and drew the helicopter along a pre-programmed path. Hyde Park opened up under them. The hotels beckoned at its edge like moored cruise liners from an earlier age. Mike had Hernán Echevarría buried in the heart of Mayfair, well away from the modern hotels. They were playing to the dictator's old-world pretensions. A royal suite at Brown's, the whiff of 2 centuries' tradition and the dropped names of European royalty amid the historical guest list. An armoured Sean limo collected Echevarría daily at the Albemarle Street frontage and ferried him about on a carefully balanced programme of meetings with senior banking officials, A-listed arms dealers, and 1 or 2 house-trained political figures. Evenings were given over to opera, and dinners with more tame dignitaries.
"I'll keep him busy," Bryant promised, "and I'll keep him away from the park end. You stash Barranco in the Hilton or something. Get a tower suite. I'll cross-reference with you on program. We'll make sure these 2 guys never come within a couple of clicks of each other."
The Hilton it was. They touched down on the tower helipad, and were met by liveried attendants who busied themselves with the baggage and led Barranco and Lopez off in the direction of the access elevators. Chris went with them, mainly to take care of tips. "You won't have to do that," he said, as the last attendant slipped out and closed the door with trained noiselessness. "Just sign gratuities on any room service you ask for and we'll cover it. I'd recommend about 10%. Expectations are a lot less than that, but it never hurts to be generous. So anyway, I hope you'll be comfortable."
"Comfortable?"
Barranco stood in the midst of the suite's opulence, looking like a hunter whose large and dangerous quarry has suddenly disappeared into the surrounding undergrowth. Chris cleared his throat. "Yes, Joaquin Lopez will be staying on the floor below, room 4148. I've put 2 armed security guards into 4146 as well. The hotel has pretty good security of its own, but you can't be too careful, even up here." He produced a small, matte black cell phone and held it out. "This is a dedicated phone, a scrambled line direct to me, wherever I am. Any problem, night or day, just call me. Just press the dial key."
"Thank you."
Barranco's tone was distant, but if there was irony in it, Chris couldn't hear it. "I thought you'd probably want to rest now."
"Yes, that would be good."
"I'd like to introduce you to a colleague of mine later on, and also to my wife. I thought perhaps we could have dinner together. There's a good Peruvian restaurant in the Hotel Mezzanine. We could eat late, say about 9:30. Or if you prefer to stay here and leave it for another night, that's entirely up to you."
"No, no. I would,"
he drew a deep, jet-lagged breath,
"like to meet your wife, Signor Faulkner, and your colleague, of course. 9:30 will be fine."
"Good. That's great. I'll call here just after 9, then."
"Yes. Now I think I would like to rest."
"Of course." He let himself out and went down to talk to the security detachment. They were pretty much what he'd expected, two hard-faced men past their physical prime in shirt-sleeves and shoulder holsters. They answered the door and then his questions with impassive calm. The surveillance equipment he'd ordered wired into Branco's suite stood unobtrusively on a low table to one side. Standby lights winked below the row of small liquid crystal screens. On one of them, Branco had already collapsed onto a bed, fully clothed. Chris bent and peered.
"He asleep?"
"Act like a light."
"You sure he isn't going to be able to find any of these cameras?"
"Yes, sir. Unless he's a surveillance specialist, and he hasn't shown any signs of looking for them yet."
"Well, let me know if he does start looking."
"Yes, sir."
"And if he moves from the suite, I want to know before it happens. You got my direct line?"
They exchanged weary glances. One of them nodded.
"Yes, sir, it's under control."
He took the hint and left to check on Lopez. The America's agent had been waiting for him. Chemical impatience made his movements about the room erratic and irritating. Chris tried to project calm.
"No transit problems, then?"
"No, man. Onward tickets."
Lopez grinned speedily.
"They don't give a fuck who you are, so long as you're going someplace else."
"And Branco, did he talk to you at all?"
"Yeah. He told me I was a running dog for the global capitalist tyranny, and I ought to be ashamed of myself."
"No change there, then." Chris wandered across to the window and stared out over the park.
"Yeah, you want to watch him, Chris. He's out of his depth with all this corporate stuff. He's going to be defensive. Most likely he'll cling to what he knows. My guess is you're going to hear a shitload of out-of-date dogma this week."
"Well, he's entitled to his point of view." That cracked Lopez up.
"Yeah, it's a free country," he chortled. "Right? Everyone's entitled to their point of view, right? It's a free country, that's right."
"Joaquin, you need to take some downers."
"No. Less time around these Maquista hero types is what I fucking need, man."
The sudden, bright vehemence brought Chris around from his contemplation of the view. Lopez was standing, glittery-eyed, in the center of the room, fists knotted, surprised by his own sudden rage. "Joaquin?"
"Ah, fuck it!"
The anger fled as rapidly as it had come. Lopez looked abruptly drained.
"Sorry. He's just my kid brother hands me the same fucking line all the time. Running dog capitalista, running dog capitalista, ever since I got my PT&I license, like a fucking skip-burned disc."
"I didn't know you had a brother."
"Yeah."
The America's agent waved a hand.
"I don't advertise the fact. Little Squirt's a union organizer in the Banana Belt up around Bocas, where we were. Not the kind of thing you put on a trade and investment CV if you can avoid it."
"I guess not." Lopez's eyes went hooded.
"I try to keep the worst of the shit from raining on him. I made contacts that are good for that much. And when the strike breakers do come around, I pay his hospital bills, I feed his kids. Gets back on his feet and he drops by to insult me again."
Chris thought feelingly of Eric Nyquist. "Family, huh?"
"Yeah, family."
The agent lost his drugged introspection, shot Chris a sideways look.
"We're just talking here, right, boss? You're not going to go telling tales on me to the partners."
"Joaquin, I don't give a shit what your brother does for a living, and neither would any of Sean's partners. They've got altogether bigger game to shoot. Everyone's got an Ollie North or two hanging in the classified record. So long as it doesn't interfere with business, so what?"
Lopez shook his head.
"Maybe that's a London attitude, Chris, but it wouldn't wash that way with Panama T&I. I don't want to wake up one morning and find myself served with a Plaza de Toros summons like you did to old man Harris."
"Hey, Harris was a fuck-up."
"Yeah, not much of a knife-fighter either, even for a gringo."
Lopez skinned an unpleasant grin, but something desperate leaked from the edges around the eyes.
"Time I reach that age, I want to be out of this fucking game. I do good work for you, Chris, right?"
"Yeah, sure." Chris frowned. Candor wasn't something he'd looked for here. Weakness, still less. The naked anxiety in the agent's tone was touching him in places he'd thought long sealed away. "And we're still not into the brutal honesty shitstorm with Branco yet. Jesus fucking Christ.
I mean, I called it right everywhere you asked me, right? I set up what you need soon as you need it, right?
You know you have. He didn't know which direction to roll this. Maybe...
I know I lost it back there in the name. I still owe you for that, but...
Joaquin, you've got to drop that shit. Chris made for the minibar, shipped bottles and ice up from the chiller unit onto a table, talking as he worked. Look, it was a problem at this end, I told you that, and I told you we look after our own. Just think about it. Christ, if you don't trust me, think about the logistics of the thing. Would I have hauled your ass out of there, with all the expense we incurred, just so I could can you 6 weeks down the line?
I don't know, Chris. Would you?
Joaquin, I'm serious. You really need to take something.
You know Mike Bryant, right?
Chris stopped, a glass in each hand. Yeah. He's a colleague, so watch what you say next, all right?
You know he's working a connoisseur portfolio at the moment, running contacts through Carlos Caffarini out of Buenos Aires.
Yeah, I heard. Didn't know it was Caffarini, but...
It isn't any more,
Lopez said abruptly.
Last week, Bryant canned Caffarini because there were call center strikes in Santiago and he didn't see it coming. Or maybe he didn't think it was important enough to chase. Now he's on a ventilator, in intensive care, until his health cover runs out, and some fucking 17-year-old is running the portfolio at a quarter the old retainer. They were only strikes, Chris. Management abuse of female workers, localized action, no political demands. I checked.
Chris put down the glasses and sighed. Lopez watched him.
Fuck, Mike. Why can't you just...
Look, Joaquin... Strikes can get out of hand, whatever the original rationale. Reed and Mason, it's Chapter 1 stuff, you know that.
Yeah.
The America's agent had the manic splinter in his tone back.
So tell me this, Chris. What's going to happen to me if a banana strike gets out of hand on a certain plantation up near Bocas?
Chris looked at him. Nothing. He kept Lopez's eyes while it sank in. All right. Got it? Nothing is going to happen to you.
You can't give me...
I am not Mike Bryant. The snap in his voice came out of nowhere, jolting them both. He clamped down on it, made his hands work on the drinks. He dumped ice into two glasses, decanted rum over the cubes, and swirled the mix. Spoke quietly again.
Look, I'm happy with what you've done for us, and I don't give a shit about what happened in Medellin. Forget about Caffarini and whatever's going on in Buenos Aires and Santiago.
I'll give you my word, you're secure with us. Now let's drink to that, Joaquin, because if you don't crank down soon, you're going to pop. Come on, this is expense account overproof rum. Get it down, you. He offered the glass. After a couple of seconds, Lopez took it. He stared into the drink for a long moment, then his face came up.
I will not forget this, Chris,
he said quietly. Nor will I. I look after my people. The glasses chimed in the room. The liquor burned down. Outside the windows, something happened to the light as afternoon shifted smoothly toward evening. Chapter 30
I still don't see why you want me there.
Carla checked her makeup again in the drop-down roof mirror as Chris rolled the Saab down into the Hilton's parking deck.
It's not like I know anything about the name.
That's exactly the point. Chris scanned the crowded deck, found nothing to his liking, and steered down the ramp to the next level.
You can get him to tell you about it. I don't want this guy to feel he's surrounded by suited experts. I want him to relax, to feel in control for a while. It's textbook client handling.
He felt her eyes on him.
What?
Nothing. The lower level was all but empty. Chris parked a good half a dozen spaces away from the nearest vehicle. Since the proximity alarm had failed on him, he'd taken to parking out in the open, where the security cameras could see him. It was irrational, he knew. No one, short of a full covert ops squad, was going to breach the perimeter defences of the Hilton or the Shawn block in the first place, let alone have time and skill to get through the Saab's security locks before they were noticed. But the proximity alarm had failed. How, exactly, was still up for grabs, but in the meantime he didn't intend it to happen again. "I'll go up and get him," he said, killing the engine. The restaurant's on the mezzanine level. El Mason Andino. Mike said he'd meet us there.
You don't want me to come up with you?
There's really no need. He didn't tell her that he wanted to check in on the security squad on the way, and that in some undefined way he felt ashamed of the two blunt, middle-aged men and their assemblage of little screens and mics.
Suit yourself.
She dug out a cigarette and put it to her lips. She seemed to draw into herself as she lit it. I'll see you there, then.
Yes.
The security men had nothing to report. On the screen, Barranco prowled back and forth like a prisoner in a cell. He had dressed in a black dinner suit a decade out of fashion. Chris went up to collect him.
I don't know much about Peruvian food, he said as they rode down in the elevator together.
Neither do I, Barranco said shortly. I'm from Colombia.
The food turned out to be excellent, though how Peruvian it was became a matter for dispute a few glasses of wine into the meal. It broke the ice with a resounding crack. Barranco argued that a couple of dishes were pure Colombian, and Chris, casting his mind back to his time in the name, had to agree. Mike, in good social form, reasoned with great persuasiveness and almost no evidence that the cuisines of the different regions must have interpenetrated over time. Carla suggested rather acidly that this probably had more to do with marketing than regional mobility. Peruvian was a consumer label here, not a national identity. Barranco nodded sober approval. He was obviously quite taken with Carla. Whether because of her blonde good looks or her unorthodox political attitudes, Chris didn't know or much care. He stowed an unexpected twist of jealousy and resisted the temptation to shift his chair closer to his wife's. Relief at the way the evening was going closed it out. Business leaked into the conversation in low-intensity bursts, mostly from Barranco's side and nurtured by the warmth of Carlo's genuine interest. Chris and Mike let it run, sonar-tuned for the dangers of political reefs and set to steer rapidly away where necessary.
Of course, solar farms are a beautiful idea, but it is the old instability argument. The infrastructure is too costly and too easy to sabotage.
Doesn't that go for nuclear power, too? I thought the regime was going to build two of those new Pollock reactors.
Yes, Barranco smiled grimly. Francisco Echevarria is a close personal friend of Donald Cordell, who is CEO of the Houghton Power Group, and the stations will be built a long way from Bogota.
Carla flushed.
That's disgusting.
Yes.
Mike shot Chris a warning glance and picked up the bottle.
Señor Barranco, more wine?
I had a question about Bogota, said Chris, feigning memory failure.
Oh, yeah, last time I was there, I saw this really beautiful church in the center of town. I was wondering...
And so on. If Barranco resented the steerage, it didn't show. He let the tides of the conversation carry him, staying polite throughout. Chris knew from the look on Carla's face that she saw what was going on, but she said nothing. Once only, when Mike Bryant retired to the toilets for the second time, did the veneer crack. Barranco nodded after him.
That kind of thing's not a problem where you work?
What kind of thing? Carla sniffed delicately. Chris looked in the direction of the toilets. He'd honestly not thought anything of it.
Well, said Barranco, I wouldn't say your colleague has a problem, but neither is he particularly subtle about it. In the Bogota Hilton, in a restaurant full of people, things would be a little different. Even our ruling families have to watch their drug stance in public these days.
Must be why Paco Echeverria spends so much time in Miami. It hit Chris just too late that he'd drunk a little too much. Barranco's eyes narrowed.
Yes, I imagine it is. Meanwhile, his father uses the helicopter gunships you buy him to firebomb coca farmers into oblivion. Ironic, isn't it?
The silence opened up. Carla made a small noise into it, a mixture of amusement and disgust that told Chris he'd get no help from that quarter.
That isn't... he stumbled. Sean policy as such doesn't outlaw coca production.
In fact, we've done feasibility studies on bringing the crop into the legitimate commodities market. Sean's Financial Instruments Division actually commissioned work along that line.
Barranco shrugged.
You expect me to be impressed? Legitimization will only send coca the way of coffee. Rich men in New York and London will grow richer, and the farmers will starve. Is that part of the package you plan to sell me here, Chris Faulkner?
That stung. More so with the fierce satisfaction he saw rising on Carla's face. Mike had not reappeared. Feeling suddenly very alone, he scrambled to salvage the evaporating good humor around the table.
You do me an injustice, Signor Barranco. I merely mentioned the study to demonstrate that at Sean we are not blinded by moralistic prejudice.
Yes, I find that easy to believe.
A small, colorless smile from Carla. Chris plunged on doggedly. In fact, I was going to say, the study found legitimization in the commodities market would be too problematic to consider seriously. For one thing, there's a very real fear that it would drain immediate finance out of practically every other investment sector, and clearly we can't have that. It was meant to be funny, but no one laughed.
Barranco leaned across the table toward him. His blue eyes were bright and marbled wet with anger.
I give you fair warning, Chris Faulkner. I have little compassion to spare for the spoiled, stupid children of the Western world and their expensive drug problems. I look through the lens that your free marketeers have sold us, and I see a profitable trade. So,
a short, hard gesture, one upward-jutting calloused palm, halfway between a karate blow and an offer to shake hands.
Sell us your weapons, and we will sell you our cocaine. This will not change when the Popular Revolutionary Brigade takes power in Colombia, because I will not sacrifice the wealth it can bring my people. If your governments are so concerned about the flow of product, let them buy up the supply on the open market like anybody else. Then they can burn it or put it up their noses as they see fit.
Hear, hear!
Mike Bryant was back, clapping slow applause as he circled the table back to his seat. His eyes burned bright enough to match Barranco's pale blue glare.
Hear, hear! Outstanding analysis, really. You were right, Chris. This is the man for us, no doubt about it.
He seated himself with a grin.
Of course, it'll never happen. Our governments don't really care enough to take that rather obvious step. They operate a containment policy in the cordon zones, so crack and edge addiction there costs them almost nothing. And the rich, well, you could always rely on the rich to take care of their own misdemeanors without recourse to public process.
Barranco looked at him with open dislike.
Strange, then, Signor Bryant, that there should have been so much loudly publicized military activity devoted to destroying the coca trade over the last 70 years.
Mike shrugged and helped himself to more wine.
Well, of course, things weren't quite as clearly defined a few decades back. There was a lot of playing to the gallery back then.
He smiled again.
Something we don't have to worry about these days.
And yet, the frigates sit at anchor in Barranquilla Harbor still, flying foreign flags. Our coastal waters are smart, mind, in contravention of UN law, and our people are showered with napalm for trying to make a living.
Another shrug.
Matters of control, Signor Barranco. I'm sure you're familiar with the dynamic. It's distasteful, I agree, but it is the stance the Echevarria government and its creditors have settled for. That, in a very real sense, is one of the reasons why we're all here right now. If we can reach a realistic agreement with you, Signor Barranco, you could be the man to change that stance.
Barranco's lip curled. Bryant, seeming to miss it, sniffed and rubbed with a knuckle at both sides of his nose.
In the meantime, you have my word as a representative of the Sean Conflict Investment Division that until the time comes to implement those changes, you'll be given access to the same covert export routes Hernan Echevarria currently turns a blind eye to.
You're going to take me to the table with Langley?
Barranco's gaze shuttled back and forth between Chris and Bryant. His tone had scaled toward disbelief.
Of course.
Mike looked surprised.
Who did you think I was talking about? They're the premier distributors of illicit narcotics in the Americas. We don't believe in doing things by halves at Sean.
I mean, we'll hook you up with some other European and Asian distributors as well, naturally. But to be honest, none of them are in the same class as Langley. Plus, you'll probably shift the bulk of your product in Langley's backyard anyway. I can do pretty good onward sales to most of the Western Pacific Rim if you're interested. More wine, anybody?
Carla drove them home, focused wholly on the road ahead. In the dashboard-lit warmth of the car, the silence came off her in waves. Chris, still smarting from the way she'd lined up with Barranco, turned away and stared out the passenger side window at the passing lights of the city.
"Well, that was fucking great," he said finally.
Carla picked up the motorway feeder lane. She said nothing. If Chris had looked at her, he would have seen how close to the edge they were. Mike in the bathroom powdering his fucking nose, Barranco on a political rant, and you backing him up every fucking...
"Don't start with me, Chris."
The Saab never wavered from its accelerating trajectory up the feeder ramp, but there was a ragged edge in Carla's voice that did finally make him look across at her face.
"Well, didn't you?" "You should be overjoyed I did. Wasn't that my job tonight? Make your client feel good? Relax him? Isn't that what you said?"
"Yeah, that didn't mean hang me out to dry in front of him."
"Well, perhaps you should have made yourself clearer. I'm your wife, remember? Not some grinning whore out of the escort pages. I don't do this shit for a living."
"You fucking enjoyed watching Barranco lay into me." It drew a sideways look from her. For a full 2 seconds, she stared at him in silence, then her eyes went back to the road.
"You going to shout like that at Mike Bryant tomorrow?" she asked quietly. "For his bathroom manners?"
"Don't avoid the fucking question, Carla."
"I wasn't aware you'd asked me one."
"You enjoyed watching Barranco lay into me, didn't you?"
"You sound pretty convinced already."
"Just fucking..." He clenched a fist, clamped his mouth, locked down the fury, forced out the words close to normal volume.
"Just answer me the question, Carla." "You answer mine first. You ever shout at Mike like this?"
"Mike Bryant is on my side. Whatever else he might do, whatever problems he might have, I know that much. I don't need to yell at him."
"Don't need, or don't dare?"
"Fuck you, Carla." It was almost a murmur. The sheeting fury had gutted out inside him. It wasn't gone, but abruptly it was cold, and that frightened him more. Frightened him because in the chill he thought he could feel something slowly dying.
"No. Fuck you, Chris."
Her voice was barely louder than his had been, but it hissed at him.
"You want an answer to your question? Yes, I enjoyed it tonight. You know what I enjoyed? I enjoyed seeing a man who's fighting for something more than his fucking quarterly bonus get the upper hand for once. I enjoyed hearing someone who cares what happens to other people telling the truth about the way your sick-making little world works."
"A man who cares."
Chris bounced the loosely curled edge of his hand off the window in the weary ghost of a punch. "Oh, sure. A man who wants to sell crack cocaine and edge to children in the zones. Yeah, he's a real fucking hero, Barranco is. You heard what he said."
"Yes, and I heard Mike Bryant promise to hook him up with Langley, who supply 80% of North America's inner cities. Langley, who you work with on a day-to-day basis. And this weekend the two of you are taking Echevarria and Barranco both to the North Memorial to sell them the weapons they need to fight each other, and now you're taking some kind of moral stance here? Jesus Christ! You could give lessons in hypocrisy to Simeon fucking Sands! What choice have we left these people, Chris? What favors have we done them? Why shouldn't they swamp us all in crack?"
"I didn't say they shouldn't."
"No. Because the truth is you don't care about that either. You don't care about anything, in fact, except making your end of the deal stick so you can stay at the top table with the other big players. That's what this is about, isn't it, Chris?"
She laughed, something that was almost a sob.
"Chris Faulkner, global mover and shaker. Observe the cut off his suits, the cool command he brings with him to the table. Princes and presidents shake his hand, and when he speaks, they listen. Oil flows where and when he says it will. Men with guns rise up and fight at his command."
"Why don't you just shut the fuck up, Carla?"
The anger was suddenly warming him again, heating his guts, looking for the way to do damage.
"You got such a thing for Barranco and his moral crusade. Maybe you should have just gone up to his fucking room with him instead of coming home with me. Maybe a man of conscience'll light you up a little better than I do."
Sudden pressure across the chest. Almost pain. The belt gripped him into his seat. He heard the brief shriek of tires as the Saab slammed to a halt.
"You fucking bastard, Chris. You fucking piece of shit."
She sat with her fists clenched on the wheel, head down. The car stood, slewed fractionally off-center beneath the sodium glare of the motorway lamps. The engine rumbled to itself. As he watched, she shook her head slowly and lifted her face. There was an unsteady adrenaline-shock smile pinned to her mouth. She shook her head again, whispered it like a discovery.
"You piece of shit!"
It was her end-of-the-line insult, the one she'd never used on him except in play. In the whole 7 years of their relationship, he'd only heard her label perhaps half a dozen acquaintances with it. Men, and on one single occasion a woman, that she wanted to wipe out of her life, and in most cases had. For Carla, it meant total shutdown, beneath contempt. He sat and felt it dripping off him like a physical thing.
"You better mean that," he said.
She would not look at him.
"This is a new level, Carla."
He looked at his hands in the stained orange radiance coming down through the windshield. There was a fierce exhilaration pumping through him that he dared not examine closely.
"We haven't been getting on, but this is new, this is."
He lifted a hand to gesture, gave it up, half-formed. It must have caught her peripheral vision. She stole a glance at him. Behind her eyes he saw fear. Not of him.
"I ought to make you get out of this fucking car."
Her voice was shaking, and he knew she was going through the same pounding, near-the-edge rush.
"I ought to make you fucking walk home." "It's my car," he said gently. "Yeah, and every centimeter I built for you, and rebuilt again. You ever, Chris, you ever speak to me like that again? You—"
"I'm sorry." It was out of his mouth before he realized he'd said it. And then they were groping for each other across the space between, tears spilling down her cheeks, stopped up, unshed in his throat, both of them held back by the idiot grip of the belts on their bodies. The solid ground of the relationship was suddenly back under their feet. The edge was gone, shoved back convulsively, the thundering pulse of the drop receding in his ears, the familiar, warm, sticky slide of remorse and regret, the safety of it all again, bearing them up and binding them together. They fought loose of the belts and held each other without speaking, long enough for the hot, wet tear ribbons on her cheeks to cool and dry against his face, long enough for the swollen obstruction in his own throat to ease and the locked-up trembling to stop.
"We have to get out of this,"
she said at last, muffled into his neck.
"I know." "It's going to kill us, Chris. One way or the other, on the road or not, it's going to kill us both." "I know." "You've got to stop." "I know." "Vasvik will come back to you. I know he will. Please, Chris, don't fuck it up when he does."
"All right." There was no resistance left in him. He felt drained. It occurred to him, for the first time in the whirl of the last 3 days.
"Have you heard anything more?"
She shook her head, still pressed against him. He found a single tear welling up in one eye. He blinked it away.
"They're taking their sweet fucking time." "Chris, it's a lot of money, a big risk for them. But we haven't heard, and that means, Dad says that means, they're going to do it. He says otherwise we'd have heard by now. They're raising the finance, justifying it at budget level. That's what he thinks."
Chris stroked her hair. Even the irritation at Carla's constant undying faith in her father's superhuman bloody wisdom was gone, temporarily dynamited in the shock of how close they'd come to the break.
"Okay, Carla.
There was a mirthless smile creeping out across his face now. "But whatever they're doing, they need to hurry it up. Someone out there's trying to kill me. Someone connected. And if they can't take me down on the road, then they'll find some other way." She raised her head to look at him.
"Do you think they know about Vasvik?"
"I don't know. But I do know that if Vasvik and his pals don't get a move on, they're going to be too late to do anything except clean up the blood. Just like Nigeria, and the Kurdish homeland, and every other fucking gig the UN have ever played." He found, oddly, his smile was gaining strength. He couldn't pick apart the knot of feeling behind it. Carlo drew back from him as if he wore a stranger's face. He looked away from her, and along the night-time perspectives of the road. "Doesn't give you much hope, does it?" Chapter 31. They got a good day for the North Memorial. The unseasonal gales drove out the cloud over the rest of the week, and by Sunday the Norfolk sky was scraped almost clear. They spotted a big jet banking lazily against the blue while they were still a dozen kilometres off.
"Surveillance, mother," was Mike's opinion. "Probably the new Lockheed. I hear they finally ironed the bugs out of the drone retrieval. They'll be showing off. Ah, here we go. Junction 17.
He swung the BMW into the off-ramp. Behind him, someone hit a horn with what sounded like both feet. Chris turned across the back seat and saw a streamlined red Ford jockeying to get past them. Beneath the tinted glass of the windshield, he made out an angry young face.
"Should have signalled, Mike." "Yeah, yeah." Mike squinted up at the mirror. "Fucking asshole. If this strip wasn't triple monitored for the fair, I'd fucking have you, my son."
"What is it?"
Barranco had been catnapping in the front passenger seat.
"Nothing," said Bryant. "Just someone looking to die young."
Barranco craned around to look. Chris shook his head not to worry and grinned. The traffic had been heavy all the way up from London. They must have seen close to 100 cars since they'd left, and as they drew closer to the Lakenheath turnoff, the density went steadily up. Bryant wasn't used to driving in these conditions. No one was. The red car edged up beside them as they hit the ramp. Bryant grinned and accelerated up the slope.
"Maybe we should have flown," Barranco said nervously.
"On a day like this?"
Mike was still grinning.
"Come on."
The Ford came level, on the right. Chris cast an eye over the vehicle's lines and reckoned cheap, look-good armoring. Probably a junior analyst or a recruitment sprog. No contest. He braced himself without thinking, and a second later Bryant fainted sideways. The other driver spooked, braked, and slewed aside. Mike carved up the space he'd left and straightened out in the middle of the lane. He started to brake a couple of dozen meters off the summit and came to a smooth halt at the roundabout junction. He waited, eyes on the mirror. After a couple of moments, the Ford crept up and queued respectfully behind them.
"Thank you," said Mike, and turned sedately onto the curve.
Barranco looked back at Chris for guidance.
"Did this mean something?"
"Not a thing," Bryant said breezily. "No challenges permissible on this stretch today. Just teaching the guy a little something about respect."
Chris winked. 10 minutes later they cleared the main gate at the airbase, and a uniformed attendant waved them through into the parking segment. The place was packed with corporate battle wagons and hired limos. Here and there, one or two khaki drab armed forces utility vehicles had been left out, mainly, Chris suspected, to enhance the genuine feel of the fair. On occasion, new developing world clients remained resolutely unimpressed by the suited godparents they had come to depend on. It helped to accentuate the military aspect, gave dictators and revolutionaries something to relate to. As they climbed out, a trio of venomous-looking fighter planes came screaming across the airfield at rooftop height, then trailed the gut-crunching roar of lit afterburners back up into the azure sky. Out of the corner of his eye, Chris saw Barranco flinch.
"Fucking clowns," he said. "Don't know why they have to do that."
"Those are hoppies," Barranco told him quietly, "demonstrating a strafe run. They are made in Britain. Last year you sold 15 of them to the Echevarria regime."
"Actually," said Mike, alarming the BMW, "they're made under license to BAE in Turkey. Have been for a couple of years now.
This way, I think."
He set off in the direction of the hangars, where a loosely knotted crowd could be seen drifting about. Chris and Branko followed him at a distance.
"You did not need to bring me here," muttered Branko.
Chris shook his head.
"I think you'll be glad we did. The North Memorial pulls in state-of-the-art weaponry from every leading manufacturer in the world. Not just the big stuff. You've got assault rifles, grenades, shoulder launchers, area denial systems.
New propellants, new ammunition, new explosives.
Vicente, even if you don't buy much of this stuff, you need to know what Echevarria might be deploying against you."
Branko fixed him with a hard look.
"Why don't you just tell me what Echevarria's got, and save us both some time?" "You don't know, do you? You supply him. You pay for it all."
"Not me."
He stamped down the coil of guilt inside him, shook his head again.
"That's not my account, Vicente. I'm really sorry. I've got no more access to it than you do."
"No, but you could get access."
Chris coughed, bent it up into a laugh.
"Vicente, that's not how it works. I can't just walk into another executive's office and go through his client files. Quite apart from the security systems, it's a question of ethics. No, seriously, I mean it. I could lose my job over something like that."
Branko turned away.
"Okay, never mind. Forget I asked. I realize you have a lot to lose."
It didn't seem to be meant ironically, and Chris thought he was beginning to get the measure of Vicente Branko enough to spot these things. Over the past 2 days, he reckoned he'd built some pretty solid scaffolding for his relationship with the Colombian. He'd had the man out to dinner at his home and actively encouraged Carla to reprise her solidarity of the night at the Hilton. He'd gone drinking with him in some semi-risky clubs at the edges of the cordon, and on the Saturday morning after, at Branko's insistence, he'd even taken him on a short tour of the eastern zones in the Saab. This last, the Colombian sat through in almost total silence, until he asked the single question, "Is this where you grew up, Chris?" It was the first time he had used Chris's first name on its own. A watershed. Chris considered a moment, then spun the wheel of the Saab and made a U-turn in the empty street. He headed southward through a maze of deserted one-way systems and roads he thought he would have forgotten by now, but had not. He found the abandoned, half-built, multi-story parking garage that overlooked the riverside estates to the west and drove up the spiral pipe to the roof. He parked at the edge and nodded forward through the windshield.
"Down there," he said simply.
Branko got out of the car and wandered to the edge of the deck. After a while, Chris got out and joined him. Riverside. The name was like a taste in his mouth, metallic bitter. He stared down at the low-stack housing, the shaggy green of miniature park spaces allowed to run wild in between, the oil-scummed expanses of water the estates backed onto on three sides. It wasn't the Bruntland, he told himself. It wasn't the labyrinthine concrete expanses of homes never designed for any but the dregs. That wasn't it. Something altogether different had gone wrong here.
"In my country,"
said Branko, echoing his thoughts with uncanny accuracy,
"you would not be considered poor if you lived here."
"It wasn't built for poor people."
The Colombian glanced back at him.
"But poor people moved in."
"Well, no one else would, you see, after the domino recessions. No facilities, no local shops, no transport, unless you could afford taxes or fuel and a license, which increasingly no one could. You want to get anywhere?"
Chris turned and pointed north.
"The nearest bus stop is 2 kilometers that way. There used to be a rail link, but the investors got scared and pulled out. When I was growing up, a few of the ones who had jobs used to cycle, but the kid gang started throwing stones at them.
They knocked one woman right off a dock into the river, kept dropping stones on her till she went under for good." He shrugged. "Having a job, a real job, marked you out." Branko said nothing. He stared down at the estate as if he could push the whole place back in time and spot the woman floundering in the oiled water.
"A couple of the kids I used to play with died that way too," said Chris, remembering clearly for the first time in a long while. "Drowned, I mean. No security fence along the wharf, see? They just fell in. My mother was always telling me not to.
He fell silent.
Barranco turned to him again.
I am sorry, Chris. I should not have asked you to come here.
Chris tried on a smile. You didn't exactly.
No, and you brought me nonetheless.
The obvious question hung there in the air between them, but Barranco never asked it. Chris was glad, because he didn't have an answer. They got back into the car.
Do you guys want to see this stuff or what?
It had dawned on Mike Bryant that Chris and Barranco were lagging behind, and he'd come back for them. Barranco exchanged glances with Chris and shrugged.
Sure, even if I don't buy much, I'll need to see what Echevarria might be deploying against me, right?
Exactly, Mike clapped his hands and snapped out a pointed pistol finger. That's the spirit.
Inside the hangars, big air-conditioning units blasted warm, spice-scented air down from the ceiling. The exhibit sat in pools of soft light, interspersed with crisp, repeating hollows, showing them in sanitized use. Brand names hung in illuminated capitals. Logos badged the walls. Bryant made for the assault rifles. An elegant saleswoman glided forward to meet him. They seemed to know each other far better than Mike's visit yesterday with Echevarria would explain.
Chris, Signor Barranco, I'd like you to meet Sally Hunting. She reps for Vickers, but she's a freelance small-arms consultant in her spare time. Isn't that right, Sal? No strings.
Sally Hunting shot him a reproachful look. Beneath her Lily Chen suit and auburn tumbling spike haircut, she was very beautiful in a pale, understated fashion.
Spare time, Mike? What is that exactly?
Sally, behave. This is Signor Vicente Barranco, a valued client, and my colleague Chris Faulkner.
Of course, Chris Faulkner. I recognize you from the photos. The Nakamura thing. Well, this is a great pleasure. So what can I do you gentlemen for?
Signor Barranco is fighting a highland jungle war against an oppressive regime and well-supplied government forces, said Bryant. It's our feeling he's under-equipped.
I see. That must be very difficult.
Sally Hunting was all mannered sympathy.
Are you relying on Kalashnikovs, Yes, I thought so. Marvelous weapons. I have clients who won't look at anything else. But you may want to consider switching to the new Heckler and Koch. Now, it's a little more complicated to operate than your basic AK, but...
Barranco shook his head.
Señorita, my soldiers are often as young as 14 years old. They come from bombed-out villages where most of the adults have been killed or disappeared. We are short of teachers, even shorter of time to train our recruits. Simplicity of operation is vital.
The saleswoman shrugged. The Kalashnikov, then. I won't bore you with details. They've been making essentially the same gun for almost 100 years. But you might like to have a look at some of the modified ammunition we have here. You know, shredding rounds, toxic jacket coatings, armor-piercing, all compatible with a standard AK load.
She gestured across at a display terminal.
Shall we?
Barranco left the North Memorial armed, on paper, to the teeth. 700 brand-new Kalashnikovs, 8 dozen Aerospatial shoulder-launched auto-seek plane killers, 2,000 lightweight King anti-personnel grenades, and 200,000 rounds of state-of-the-art ammunition for the assault rifles. They were unable, despite Sally Hunting's best efforts, to sell him landmines or a complex automated area-denial sentry system.
No big deal, she told them while Barranco was with one of the clinical experts, having immune inhibitor toxins explained to him. I'll get standard commission on the AKs. Not as much as the Heckler and Koch, obviously. They're still trying to break the lock Kalashnikov have on the insurgency market, and they're being very generous this year. Still, with what I'll make off the Aerospatial staff and the grenades, I'm not complaining.
I'm glad to hear that, growled Mike, because my impression was I just handed you a crippled rabbit on a 4-lane drag. You owe me big time for this, Sally.
She twinkled at him.
Collect any time, Mike. I'm a busy girl, but I can always fit you in, you know.
Behave.
On the drive back, Barranco was quiet. If his new acquisitions pleased him, he gave no sign. For the whole journey he held a single jacketed rifle slug in his hand,
rolling it back and forth between his fingers like a cigar. His face invited neither conversation nor comment. He looked, Chris thought in one particularly morbid moment, like a man who has just been told he has a disease for which there is no known cure. Chapter 32. They dropped Barranco at the Hilton and were about to pull away again when the security entry alarms went off in violently coloured LED and nasal braying. Still buried in his brooding, the Colombian had tried to walk through the scanner with the AK round in his hand. Chris nipped up the steps to the entrance and unwrinkled things, clapped Barranco on the shoulder and told him to get some rest. He'd see him at 9 the next morning to go over contractual stuff. Then he piled back in the BMW, and they drifted out into the sparse traffic. Mike hooked around Marble Arch and picked up Oxford Street heading east. Still plenty of light in the sky.
"Want to get something to eat?" Mike asked him.
"Sure, why not?"
"Noodles?"
"Sounds good to me."
Chris jerked a thumb back the way they'd come.
"You think he's okay?"
"Barranco? Yeah, just shell-shocked. Probably never seen so much hardware in a single day."
"I don't know. He didn't look happy."
Mike snorted.
"Well, he bloody should be happy. That's the biggest single credit card payment I've ever made."
"You didn't buy any toys for Echevarria yesterday?"
"On account," Mike grinned at him. 60-day cancellation clause."
"You route that stuff through Sally Hunting as well?"
"No way. Total account separation, remember? Anyway, Sally doesn't get her commission until the money clears. Wouldn't want—"
The BMW's phone lit up with a priority call. Mike made a quiet gesture at Chris and answered.
"Yeah, Bryant?"
"Mike, it's Troy. That stuff about Faulkner you ran past me. Something came up."
"Right. He's here with me, Troy. Tell us what you got."
There was a brief pause.
"It's better we meet. I don't want to talk on this line. Can you come out to my place?"
Mike glanced across at him. Chris nodded.
"We're on our way."
Troy's house seemed strangely quiet in the early evening light. It took Chris a moment or two to understand that he was comparing it with memories of the last time he'd been here, when the party was in full swing. He got a determined lock on his creeping paranoia and followed Mike up to the front door. The worry must have shown on his face. Mike grinned encouragingly at him.
"Be all right," he said.
Troy Morris answered the bell by Securicam before he opened up, ushered them in as if there were a storm coming, and then threw every bolt and security device the door had before he spoke again. The anti-temper unit whined rapidly up to full charge. Mike looked at Chris and raised an eyebrow.
"Little jumpy, aren't we?"
"You'd better come through," said Troy. "Someone I want you to meet."
In the living room, a thin black man in his early 20s sat twitching relentlessly in one of Troy's armchairs. There was a scar across his lower jaw, and his clothes said, "Zone Gangwit." He surveyed the new arrivals without enthusiasm.
"This is Marauder," Troy told them. "Marauder, this is Mike Bryant, Chris Faulkner. Friends of mine."
Yeah, whatever."
"Mike, Chris, you want to sit down? Get you a drink?"
Mike Bryant nodded, most of his attention fixed on Marauder.
"Some of that Polish vodka you keep in the freezer. Small one."
"Chris, single malt, right?"
"Yeah, if you've got it, thanks."
"Aberlour or Lagavulin? Or I've got Irish."
"Lagavulin's good. No ice."
"Marauder?"
The gangwit rolled his head once, back and forth, slowly. He said nothing. Troy shrugged and went out to the kitchen. They sat and waited. The silence stretched.
"Who you run with?" Mike asked suddenly.
Marauder lifted his jaw.
"Fuck's he got to do with you?"
Chris tensed. Neither he nor Mike was carrying, and Marauder looked street enough to be a problem in a straight fight. He checked Mike out of the corner of his eye, but saw no signs of impending violence.
"Just curious," Mike said lazily. "Just wonder what kind of fuckwit outfit lets its soldiers get strung out on the merchandise."
Marauder sat up.
"Hey, birdshit, you want to fuck with me?"
"You don't understand,"
Mike Bryant's voice was patient. "I'm a suit. I represent the establishment. I've wanted to fuck with you. You'd be in a penal hospital donating a kidney to society, and your mum'd be out on the street evicted and giving blowjobs to pay your post-op. Sit down." The gangwit was up out of his chair. On the way there, he'd magicked a blade out between the knuckles of his right hand. He brandished it.
"Hey, fuck you, birdshit."
"I'd put that away as well if I were you. Touch me and I'll have your fucking house bulldozed. That's a promise."
Marauder dithered, rage etched into his stance. If Mike had gotten up to meet him, Chris reckoned the gangwit would already have slashed at him.
"Ernie, put that fucking thing away before I take it off you myself."
It was Troy, back with a tray of bottles and glasses and an exasperated look on his face.
"What do you think this is, the Carlton Arms lounge bar? This is my fucking home."
"Ernie?"
A huge grin lit up Bryant's face.
"Ernie?"
"You behave as well, Mike. You should know better."
Troy nodded at the gangwit, who looked away and snicked the blade back out of sight. He lowered himself onto the front edge of the armchair. Chris felt the tension leaking slowly out of him and breathed again. Mike examined the nails of his right hand. Troy Morris hadn't even put down the drinks tray.
"That's better."
"Call yourself a black man," Marauder muttered weakly. "Fucking line up with them every time, you nearly birdshit yourself."
"I've belt up."
Troy wasn't even looking at him anymore. He handed drinks around and parked the tray on a coffee table, settled into the remaining armchair with a whiskey of his own, and gestured.
"This fine example of urban youth has a story to tell. I told him you'd pay him."
"Well..."
Mike looked up at the ceiling.
"That seems fair. Let's hear it, Ernie."
There was a sullen, hate-filled pause. Everyone looked at Marauder.
"Going to cost you?"
he said finally, looking at Chris. 200, Chris told him. "That's a promise. Maybe more if I like it."
"You ain't going to like it at all," the gangwit sneered.
He seemed to be getting back his poise.
"You're Faulkner. Knew that 'cause I seen you on the TV. Big popular driver, right? Well, turns out you ain't so fucking popular after all. Turns out someone thinks you're a fucking sellout."
Chris felt his guts chill. "Go on." Marauder nodded.
"Yeah, that's it. Craig's posse got the word. Jack a wagon, put a Sicario behind the wheel. Someone pay out 50 grand to have you bunnied."
"That's not so much."
"It is around the crags, Mike," Troy said somberly. "You can get a Sicario hit on your rescue's patch for a grand, grand and a half. Maybe 5 if they have to go into town."
"Well, expenses," Mike gestured. "Jack in the car."
Marauder sneered again.
"Wasn't no fucking Jack, birdshit. That guy, he knew they were coming. Your rescue sent his spark men and data rat up to Kilburn to wire that wagon 2 days before it was jacked. Fucking suit new, man. They paid him for it."
"How do you know all this?" Chris asked him.
"Defector. I run with the Gold Hawks."
Mike Bryant threw up his hands.
"Well, why was it such a big fucking secret before? You're telling us now like it was nothing. Fucking..."
"Mike, shut up." Chris looked back at the gangwit. "Yeah, the Gold Hawks. And?"
Marauder shrugged. "Like I said, defector. The Sparkman, he came over. He's black. The Craigs are a birdshit gang. They only ever tolerated him for the wire work. He's got a new girl in Acton now. Suits him to get out from under your rescue. He told me this shit couple of nights ago. I heard Troy was asking so. Like that."
Troy leaned forward.
"Now tell them what the Sparkman was doing to the wagon." "Yeah. Said they put in a frequency jammer."
Chris and Mike looked at each other.
"A what?" "Sparkman didn't know much about it."
Marauder seemed to be settling into his role as storyteller.
"The data rat did most of the work. Seems like he told him it was a system to trick out some kind of alarm. Very expensive, he said. Your rescue got it given to him specially."
Chris nodded to himself. "Uh-huh. Mike? Believe me now?"
"Shit."
Mike threw himself to his feet.
Marauder twitched, but by then Bryant was at the window, staring out.
Shit.
You said someone thinks I'm a sellout. Chris focused on the gangwit. He had to ask. What does that mean? Who told you? The Sparkman?
Sure. Yereski was full of it, talking up how the suits were selling each other out, how this guy Faulkner wasn't a team player, he didn't belong, and that's how come he was getting greased.
Chris, that could just be Yereski reinforcing his own loyalty system. Look how much better we are than these fucking suits, fucking each other over at every opportunity. Not like us, we stand together, and I'm the best fucking boss you ever had. Someone outside Sean could have gotten hold of the prox frequencies on the Saab if they were jacked in at the right level. Lloyd Paul, Nakamura, maybe. Any of them could have bought the information.
I don't think so. Outside the car, it was getting dark. The buildings of the financial district loomed around them as Mike threaded the BMW through deserted streets toward the Sean block. Most of the lights in the towers were out, and there was a ghost town hush over the whole place. The emptiness of Sunday dying, like the last day of some cycle of civilization now reaching its end. Chris felt the chill leaking into him again.
Why would they do it that way, Mike? It doesn't make sense. Why trust some punk sicario more than one of your own drivers? Comes to another tender, they can feel the best they've got against me.
Not if they wanted to use that trick with a jammer. Trade standards authorities would be all over them like a crack whore. They'd fine them into bankruptcy.
Exactly, Chris shook his head. It doesn't pay a major corporation to break the rules for the sake of a single driver. Not when there's no money in it.
So maybe it was personal. Mitsui Jones's family or something.
Same applies, Mike. They lose the insurance, the pension, the bereavement pay. Fuck it, they go to jail. Nakamura would drop them like vomit, and with no corporate protection, more than likely Sean would have them greased just to make an example.
If they get caught. And revenge is a powerful...
You think I don't fucking know that? I...
Chris got a leash on himself, appalled at what he'd been about to tell the other man.
You're reaching, Mike. How many families of men you crashed have come after you?
None, but...
That's right, none. This is the way things get done, Mike. Road raging is here to stay. No one breaks the rules anymore. They test, they probe, they hammer out new road precedent, but nobody does this. Nobody goes to the trouble unless it's a hard cash reason, and that means someone inside Sean.
You're thinking Macon?
Or Hewitt?
Bryant shook his head. The Sean block appeared, and he drew to a halt a few meters off the car deck security entry. He leaned his arms on the steering wheel, stared up at the blank face of the tower.
All right, he sighed. Let's assume you're right.
Yes, let's.
Let's assume the fix was in, like you said, from inside Sean. That means you were right about driver control as well. You know Liz has contacts with those guys. Maybe I'll give her a call, get her to do me a favor and ask some questions in the right places.
What?
Chris looked around, trying to squeeze the sudden pulse of alarm back out of his voice.
Liz Linshaw.
Ah, maybe that's not... is that a good idea? Involving her?
Relax, you could trust Liz with your life.
Yeah, but I thought you and her were, you know, over.
Mike grinned.
That woman... No way. It runs hot and cold, depends on what else is going on in our lives, but it's like gravity. No escape for either one of us. Longer we stay apart, hotter it is when we finally fuck. The last time she left this bite on my shoulder, you wouldn't believe.
Chris stared hard at the dashboard.
Yeah? What did Suki have to say about that?
Well, Mike's grin turned conspiratorial. You're not going to believe this either, but you know what I did? Went back to the office. Smashed myself in the nose with the end of that baseball bat I've got.
What?
Yeah, fucking agony. Gave myself a serious nosebleed. Dripped it all over my practice GI. Told her I'd snagged a psycho in a sparring session.
Chris remembered the bruised nose from a few weeks back.
That's what you told me, too.
Well, yeah. Didn't want to force you to lie for me if it ever came up with Suki.
Mike Bryan's expression grew musing.
You know, if it weren't that I already had Suki and Ariana, I really think Liz might have been the one.
You think so, do you?
Mike nodded sagely.
Yeah, I do. She's really something, Chris.
On the shorn car deck, the Saab stood isolated in the gloom. Anyone else clocking weekend time had gone home for dinner. Chris sat in the car for a long time before he started up, the quiet whined in his ears. Across the deck, a faulty roof light spattered on and off like an obscure distress signal. It felt as if he was waiting for someone. When he finally powered up the Saab and got out into the streets, it was like driving in a dream. The city slid by on either side of him as if cranked past on rollers. The Saab's interior was a bubble of neurasthenic calm, a safe place he was scared he might not be able to leave easily. The dashboard and wheel, pedals and shift, gave him remote control and a distant autopilot strength. Options murmured in his ear. Let's go there. No, here. No. Fuck going anywhere. Let's just leave. Leave it all behind. He was almost into the streets of Highgate before the autopilot neurasthenia cut out, and he realized this was not the way home. File number 4. Capital Volatility. Chapter 33. Carla was already asleep when he got in. He vaguely remembered she told him something about a crack of dawn start with Mel's recovery unit on the western periphery. Partnership trials in some structural adjustment consultancy. Chris had never heard of them, but these days that wasn't so unusual. He had a lot less to do with adjusting programs now he was out of emerging markets, and new SAP consulting groups were always springing up, like mushrooms on a manure heap. It wasn't rocket science, after all. Slash public health and education spending, open to foreign capital flows, dynamite local blockages in the legal and labor sectors. Lie about the results and get the local military to crush inconvenient protest. A trained ape could do it. You could get the paper qualifications by distance learning inside 10 weeks. Then all it took was a suit and a driver's license. He stood in the bedroom watching Carla sleep, and was overcome by a wave of almost unbearable tenderness. He pulled the quilt up a little higher around her shoulders, and she muttered something without waking. He slipped out, closed the door gently behind him, and went downstairs to the study. Behind another closed door, he ran the porn segment of Liz Linshaw and her plastically enhanced playmate. He sat for an hour, head propped on one hand, trying to sort out what he felt. He slept badly, twisted by brutal dreams that evaporated in vague traceries of impending menace when he finally awoke. Carla was gone. Her side of the bed was almost cold, and light was streaming in through half-open curtains. The bedside clock said 8:10. Fuck! He got out from under the quilt, groped after shirt and trousers, and got them on. In the bathroom mirror he stared at the angry eyes and the stubble, picked up a razor, then flung it into the basin and settled for sticking his head under the cold tap. Chilly water trickled around his neck and down his back. He raked it out of his hair, crushed a towel over his head without taking it off the rail, and closed his shirt. Slung a tie around his neck, shoes and cuffs, wallet and watch, into the jacket and out the keys, fuckwit. He ran back upstairs. Couldn't find them on the bedside table. Remembered his vigil in the study, darted in and grabbed them up off the desk. He kicked the Saab backward out of the driveway, swerved untidily around in the road at the bottom, and left rubber on the worn grey asphalt as he took off westward. He made the Elsinham ramp in record time. Rolling in past Junction 10, he checked his watch. Couple of minutes off 8:45. Great. Fucking great. He put through a call to Branco at the Hilton. There was no answer from the room. Growing irritation sprouted suddenly into irrational fear. He cut the connection, redialed for the security detail. Someone answered on a yawn.
Yeah.
Faulkner, what happened to Branco?
What's the matter? He not turn up yet?
Chris felt a spike of ice run him through the heart.
Turn up where?
The voice on the other end got suddenly deferential.
Sean, sir? Weren't we supposed to let him go? He took the secure limo. Called Sean for it to come and get him.
Foot to the floor now, head still fogged, think. "Who authorized the fucking limo?" he grated.
I can check.
You do that. Do it now, and stay on the line. He summoned a map of the day from memory and tried to place Hernán Echevarría on it. His head refused to cooperate. Breakfast with the partners, or was that Tuesday? Touring Miltech's new smart mine facility in Crawley? If that was it, he was already out of town under Mike Bryant's watchful eye. He felt the tension ease a little. Security came back online from their room in the Hilton.
"Transit was authorized at partner level," the voice said, smug with belated relief. "Louise Hewitt. She said she was surprised you weren't around to cover it."
"Ah, shit."
"Was there anything else, sir?"
Chris made a noise in his throat and killed the connection. The Saab barreled down the approach road to the first underpass. He was on the raised section that ran across the northern zones when he suddenly remembered where Mike Bryant and Hernán Echevarría were that morning. He floored it again. The damage was done. He knew. Jolting the Saab into a space as close to the elevators as he could get, he knew and wondered why he was still bothering. Riding up alone with a chatty elevator voice for company, he knew and nearly screamed aloud at the waiting. Shouldering past a brace of startled admin assistants on the 52nd floor, he knew beyond doubt. Staring at the coded entry door to the covert viewing chamber, the nightmarish confirmation of its carelessly ajar angle, he knew. Still, through all the knowing, as he threw the door all the way open and saw Barranco standing there, it hit him like sludge in his guts. Beyond the glass, Nick Makin and Mike Bryant sat with Hernán Echevarría and another uniform, apparently discussing interrogation training. Their voices strained through into the chamber. A brittle burst of laughter rang so sharp it was almost static. "Vicente." Barranco turned the face of a corpse toward him. He was pale beneath his tan, mouth drawn down tight, a vein beat at one temple.
"Hijos de puta," he whispered. "You!"
In the conference room, Echevarría was nodding sagely.
"Vicente, listen to me."
He flinched back, went halfway to karate guard as he saw Barranco's eyes. The Colombian was trembling. He wondered fleetingly what combat skills honed in genuine combat would look like up against his corporate Shotokan training. Barranco looked at him with sick wonder and then turned away. He stood staring down at the desk where someone had left a bound copy of the Echevarría schedule.
"I did not believe," he said quietly, "when the assistant told me. Asked me if I was with Hernán Echevarría, if I had gotten lost, and brought me here, smiling. Fucking smiling. Let me in here to watch you."
"Vicente, this isn't what it looks like."
"It is exactly what it looks like."
The yell rang in the confines of the chamber. It seemed impossible those beyond the glass wall could not hear. Barranco lashed out with one foot. The desk skidded, spilled schedule, associated discs and papers. A chair fell, caught Mike's baseball bat and sent it rolling.
"Vicente."
In his own ears, Chris could hear the pleading in his voice.
"You must have known Echevarría was still at the table. But he's out now. You're in. Can't you see that?"
The Colombian turned back to face him, crook-handed.
"In," he hissed. "Out. What is this, a fucking game to you? What do you have in your veins, Chris Faulkner? What the fuck kind of human being are you?"
Chris licked his lips. "I'm on your side, Vicente."
"Side? On my side?" Barranco spat on the floor. His voice scaled up again. "You grinning fucking whore! Don't talk to me about sides! There are no sides for men like you, a friend to murderers."
He gestured at the glass, eyes glistening.
"To torturers, if it pays.
You are a fucking waste, a soulless gringo puto, a stench.
Something ripped open behind Chris's left eye. He felt himself flinch physically with the impact. Red-veined wings billowed upward in his head. The HM file opened for him like a brightly colored trap door. He saw helicopters hanging from a tattered cloud rainforest sky, whine and clatter of gatlings, whoosh, thump of rockets, villages in flames, cremated trees, charred bundles scattered across the scorched earth. He heard the discordant jail cell screams spiking a tropical night, a visitation he hadn't had since the death of Edward Quayne was there beside him, shouting hoarse in his inner ear. The bat. It was in his hand. The door code. Five tiny, creeping touches across the keypad. The glass door hinged back, and he erupted into the conference.
Faulkner! What the fuck are you doing?
Makin, voice almost girlish in shock. Mike, turning from a side table where he was mixing drinks. Echevarria, eyes fixed past Chris on Branko, his swollen old man's face mottled and worked as he struggled to his feet, voice reedy with outrage.
This is...
Chris hit him, side on, both hands, full swing with a baseball bat and all he had behind it, into the dictator's ribs. He heard the bones go, felt the brittle crunch through the bat. Echevarria made a noise like a man choking and slumped against the edge of the table. Backswing, in again, same spot. The old man shrilled. Mike Bryant waded in. Chris stabbed him handily in the solar plexus with a bat end. Bryant staggered and sat down against the wall, whooping for breath. The other uniform bellowed and tried to get around the table to his boss. He tangled in his own chair and went over backward. Chris swung again. Echevarria raised an arm. The bat broke it with an audible snap. The old man screamed, back up, and swung again. He got the face this time. The dictator's nose broke, the bone over one eye caved in, blood ripped out, spraying warm and wet on his own face and hands. Echevarria went down and lay on the floor, curled fetally and still screaming. Chris spread his stance low and wide and chopped down as if he were splitting logs. Head and body. An indiscriminate frenzy of blows. He heard hoarse yelling, and it was his own. Blood everywhere, running off the bat, in his eyes, the white glint of exposed bone in the mess at his feet. Choking, bubbling sounds from Echevarria. The other uniform came flailing around the table at last. Chris, down now to adrenaline-cold clarity, swung about and let him have the bat sideways across the throat with a full swing. The man jerked back as if tugged on an invisible string. He hit the floor like an upturned beetle strangling noisily. Everything stopped. On the floor, Echevarria made a bubbling sigh and fell silent. A meter and a half off, Nick Makin had finally made it to his feet.
Faulkner!
Chris hefted the bat. His face twitched. His voice seemed to come from the bottom of a well, rasping tones unrecognizable in his own ears.
"Back off, Nick. I'll do you, too."
He heard Mike crawling to his feet. He looked back to the door he'd come in.